to the fifth case of the day, the United States v. Escobedo. Mr. Land?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I am Seth Land, and I represent Defendant Appellant Moises Escobedo. As this Court has often noted, the exigent circumstances exception to the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement is an important law enforcement tool that has legitimate applications. But this Court has also noted the limitations of that exception. Here, the trial court, in denying the defendant's motion to suppress, misapplied the exception, extending it beyond its correct limits when it found that Fort Wayne police officers had offered an objectively reasonable basis for entering Mr. Escobedo's rented house at 6102 Downingtown Drive and arresting him without a warrant.
And I want to hear what your arguments are on that, but sort of from a bottom line standpoint, even if we agree with you that there were no exigent circumstances, why wouldn't the statements that were made by your client at the police station after Miranda was given be admissible,
Your Honor,
under New York versus Harris?
Yes, Your Honor, because probable cause did not exist here. The evidence, if you actually break it down, at the time that this arrest took place, consisted of the statements of Rachel Summers, who is an unreliable, unverified informant that none of these police officers had any prior experience with or any basis for corroborating or bolstering her credibility. She was a person who had been arrested in Phoenix carrying marijuana, and she had implicated Mr. Escobedo. Mr. Escobedo had not been observed to engage in any illegal contact or any illegal conduct. He hadn't been overheard in the intercept saying anything except in the most vague terms about drugs.
So then the officers who were listening in on the phone conversations who reported that the conversation between Summers and Escobedo, that they heard Escobedo ask Summers where his marijuana was since there was only straw in the trunk?
Your Honor, he didn't say where's the marijuana. He said and I'm not sure they overheard that. It was taped, but I think she reported to them that what he had said is, what is this? And then he used an expletive in the trunk. He didn't say, what is the marijuana? And Mr. Escobedo said when he testified, he was surprised. He was expecting to find tools. She had told him that the car was overheated. He'd advised her to stop and buy some tools to fix the faulty thermostat, and he was confused. He opened the trunk of his car, and he found some bales of plastic hay or straw. So that's all he said. That's not probable cause to arrest. None of his conduct up to that point is necessarily inconsistent with someone who was concerned that she was driving a car back that he had some sort of interest in. They had had some conversations that the car was faulty. And, you know, it's perfectly plausible that up to that point, Ms. Summers had decided to implicate either to get preferential treatment for herself or to protect someone else. But he hadn't done anything that rose to the level of probable cause. The lack of probable cause not only means that Mr. Escobedo's statements post-arrest at the police station should also be suppressed, but, of course, because probable cause, in addition to the exigent circumstances, is necessary to take this case out of the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement, it's an additional reason for suppressing all of the results of the police intrusion.
But of course, when you attack Summers, you're not really talking about how she was seized with the 300 pounds of marijuana in the car and all the things that happened beforehand, because that sort of credits her as someone they can believe when you're trying to factor in the probable cause analysis.
Well, I mean, the mere fact that she was in trouble doesn't mean that that's not a reason in and of itself. The case law says that she doesn't have any credibility. But all of the cases, including the cases cited, I believe, on page 25 of the government's brief, about the credibility of confidential informants as it goes to probable cause, all deal with cases where there was some sort of corroboration. They emphasize the need for there to be some sort of independent corroboration. And here, the only thing that was corroborated is that she got him to show up at the Southgate Shopping Center on the day in question to meet him and exchange cards. That's really all that existed up to that point. So we don't
believe... And her testimony that she was working for him.
And what she said to the police officers, that she was working for him. But again, that suggests that perhaps she was in league with somebody, but...
In league with him. she's his courier.
Up to a point, Your Honor.
300 pounds of marijuana. How is that not probable cause if he shows up at the designated meeting place?
Well, he shows up at the designated meeting place to exchange a car with her. At that point, at the point which
a
they arrest...
A car that he thinks, based on their course of conduct, contains 300 pounds of marijuana.
Your Honor, a car that, according to her, he believes, he hadn't done anything up to that point that suggested that he believed the car contained marijuana.
So we should throw out the regular phone, cell phone contact that she had with Escobedo during the trip. She had that. That was also...
Your Honor, it wasn't argued below that those conversations should be excluded, and so therefore we hadn't raised that in our brief.
So they were part of the... I mean, when you're talking about corroboration, because your big thing is you're attacking Summers. And so we have these phone records where they're, like, chatting back and forth. We don't know the content, but that certainly helps to bolster her from a credibility.
Well, but, Your Honor, it's also important that in all those conversations with him, he doesn't say anything about marijuana. Again, there's one very vague reference that uses an expletive that could mean just about anything, and is garbled. But he doesn't say, you got my drugs, how are my drugs doing, anything like that. He doesn't say weed. He doesn't say... any of the euphemisms for marijuana or for drugs.
You're asking us to ignore the entire context. I think your stronger argument is that, you know, there was time once they followed him to the house to, you know, put the house under surveillance and go get a warrant, rather than trying to suggest that there wasn't probable cause here.
Well, I could, and I think that's true, Your Honor, but let me just say, I think that context is all after the fact. If we're focusing on the moment at which, on August 19th, they made the intrusion into that home, I don't think there was any independent corroboration other than the fact that he met her in a parking lot and exchanged a car. There was nothing else at that point. Now, as far as the exigent circumstances go, the government has offered what are essentially imperfect circumstances of the stakeout and argued that those are exigent. But imperfect law enforcement circumstances are not emergency or exigent circumstances. In fact, any time that law enforcement approaches a stakeout or a suspect's home or a place that a suspect is holed up, presumably there is some danger. But the fact that there is danger cannot by itself create exigent circumstances. If it did, this exception would swallow the Fourth Amendment's warrant requirement and would be contrary to all of the case law of this circuit that emphasizes the narrowness of the exigent circumstances. What the government has argued is that, and none of these really stand up to scrutiny, even if they have a facial appeal, they argue, first of all, they were concerned about Summers' safety. But there was never any reason, objectively, at any moment, for anyone to be concerned about Summers' safety, nor was she concerned about her safety. There was no testimony by her about violence. She never worried about violence. You can listen to the phone conversations. There's cordial back and forth. And, of course, at the moment at which the intrusion into the house on Downingtown Drive was ordered, Ms. Summers was far away from that scene. She was back at the Southgate Mall under the watchful eye of Detective Ray. So there was never any possible danger to her. And, Your Honor, I see my white light is on. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thanks. That's all right. Thank you.
Mr. Geller.
Good morning. Anthony Geller on behalf of the United States. Obviously, there's not really any dispute with regard to the law surrounding exigent circumstances. It's a very fact-intensive sort of inquiry. From the government's perspective, I think it's important to distinguish a couple of things first off in analyzing the factual circumstances here. First of all, we're not really dealing with a destruction of evidence situation. We are to a certain extent because stash houses typically have things that can be destroyed, but quite frankly, there was no belief that the subjects inside the house were going to destroy, you know, a trunk load full of straw. And frankly, it didn't matter if they did. So the evidence destruction thing is really not the primary point of the government's exigent circumstances argument. The primary point is safety, not only to the officers, but to the surrounding community and even to the suspects in this case. And I think when you look at these cases, there is a difference when you balance out the factors. in terms of what is the justification. Is it safety on the one hand, or is it evidence of obstruction on the other? And you can see that difference when you look at cases such as Collins and such as the Patino case that are in the defendant's reply that were more strictly evidence destruction sort of cases. And, for example, the Venters case, which was the case that actually involved prior knowledge of CPS workers and law enforcement about child neglect in a location. And then when they arrive, they see circumstances that there was a lethargic kid on the couch that wasn't responding to the knocks at the door. So when you see those two sorts of situations, I think it's important to start from that premise that we're talking about safety issues.
Yeah, but here we don't. Here is fake marijuana in there. There's no indication they're getting ready to leave. There's no indication that anybody has any weapons. I mean, I think your exigent circumstances argument is kind of a loser. Summers is not even on site. I mean, it's in your better position. I mean, you agree that even if there weren't exigent circumstances, if there was probable cause for the arrest and his later statement at the police station, that's a justification. I mean, the statements come in and you're golden.
I think you're clearly right on the second point.
I just think you're really a stretch in this circumstance.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree with regard to the exigent circumstances. I do agree with you as far as there's quite clearly a probable cause. The statements are going to come in. The warrant process is already underway. There's clearly probable cause to arrest Mr. Escobedo or to go in and look for evidence. So the warrant is going to be obtained inevitably, no matter what. But again, I would disagree with regard to the exigent circumstances point that you're making for a number of reasons. It's really the combination of all these factors. It's not simply the informant, the danger to the informant, the situation at the house and such. It's all these things together. And I think you have
But the danger to the informant wasn't even in the house. The informant was
right.
20 minutes away at the mall. So
right.
What's the danger to her? She's protected.
The danger to the informant is the presence potentially of counter surveillance. Officers, unfortunately, don't have the luxury to know necessarily, this individual in the black Camaro over here is a counter surveillance individual placed there by Mr. Escobedo or the surrounding organization. You have testimony, expert testimony from the officers with regard to counter surveillance is a very common technique with regard to drug trafficking organizations of this nature. Number two, Mr. Escobedo himself places in the mind of the informant and in the minds of the officers that counter surveillance is going to be present. As you would recall from the evidence, especially the recording, Mr. Escobedo is in constant contact with the informant, and he's actually essentially guiding her in, saying that I'm at this location, I'm at this restaurant, you'll see the semi with the boat and such. And when she passes where she thinks he is at, he says, he gets on the radio and says that he sees her. And she says, well, that's not where you said you were going to be. He says, well, I know. You can kind of hear that intonation on the recorder. Additionally, we have the presence of counter surveillance at the house. We have lookout behavior. There are at least two individuals that come out, look up down the street and such. So we actually have not only Escobedo, but we have other individuals who are present who are engaging in counter surveillance. And then finally, we have a significant shipment here. We have a shipment that, based on the expert testimony, has a value somewhere in the $250,000 to $300,000+ range. And when you have those types of organizations, when you have that type
right,
of dope.
Right, and the shipment was significant, but what was in the house, and we're talking about, whether or not you could go in and search the house. The house had the hay.
Well, the house had the hay, and the house potentially had whatever else, indicia of drug evidence is in a stash house as well. And the house also had Escobedo.
Right, but you didn't have any evidence. There was no evidence of what else was in the house other than the hay.
Other than what the officer's expertise is in these situations. And as you recall from the suppression testimony, the officer's expertise is that there are frequently guns, assault rifles, those sorts of things involved with these sorts of drug organizations because they're afraid to get robbed, afraid to get burglarized, and that sort of thing. So the presence of counter-surveillance and the presence of weapons, even though those things might not have been found, from the officer's perspective prior to the entry into the house, they don't know those things aren't there. And based on their expertise, based on their experience, those things are quite commonly present in those situations. Additionally, with regard to safety concerns, we have a neighborhood with rather unique surveillance problems. The neighborhood had some intertwining streets. There were significant fences in the back. there was a significant danger of not only the Crown Victoria, but also potentially the red pickup truck on the outside getting into a vehicle pursuit of some form. There's the potential of an individual escaping out of the back on foot with all the neighborhood houses there. There's a possibility of a residential entry, putting people in harm's way. So the bottom line is that all these factors came together. As far as the ability to surround the house, the court below found factually that it simply wasn't the case. It wasn't possible. The officers did not have a perimeter, and they could not establish a good perimeter around the house to cut off those escape routes. And then the gig was up, basically. Based on the comment on the recording, the officers knew that Mr. Escobedo found out about the shipment, and the cops were on their way and likely present, and therefore that created additional dangers. So the officers simply couldn't barricade the house, because then, given their experience, given their expertise about weapons being involved with drug traffickers, they simply can't sit out in front of the house when individuals inside are behind cover and concealment. So they are, quite frankly, in the line of fire and cannot address that situation adequately. I would note that in the defense reply brief, there were there's mention of Collins and Patino being cases that were that the defense or that the appellant alleges are similar to this situation. I would contrast those if you would note that those cases actually involved officers who knew where they were going. They had prior information about the location that was eventually searched, and that was not the case in this particular instance. The officers had no idea where they were going. I would highlight for the court also the Campbell case out of the Sixth Circuit. It deals with a pseudo-controlled delivery, very similar to this one, where you have a package case where they had an anticipatory warrant for the delivered location, but then it was unexpectedly taken to a separate location. And then, basically the New York versus Harris issue and the inevitable discovery issue, I think, are quite clear. I mean, there's absolutely no question there's probable cause here. I mean, the jury found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt based essentially on the same factors leading to probable cause. You have to consider the context of the situation. And as far as counsel's statements about he simply went and switched a car, that really doesn't take into account all of the conduct highly indicative of a drug trafficker that was observed by the surveillance officers. We have the individuals actually go into a store essentially to disguise the fact that they're meeting and switching vehicles. We have Mr. Escobedo backing into the house. We have the lookout behavior. We have all those sorts of things, and certainly have all the statements on the recordings. And I suppose for purposes of probable cause, the thing that might be important about the first call is that he actually was afraid of a police car and made statements to that effect. So I see my time is over, or almost over. And if there's no other questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Geller. So on.
Your Honor, just briefly again about exigent circumstances. The theory that the government advances based on the officer's experience about what often happens at drug houses could be used to justify exigent circumstance in any circumstances. In terms of the house, the trial court did not make a factual finding it couldn't be surrounded. It made factual findings that the officers testified that some of their lines of sight were occluded. One officer said, well, I can see the front but not all of the back. Well, that's not big surprise. That's always going to be the case. There were at least five officers, by my reckoning, around this house. It was an ordinary suburban house. I don't think a photo of it, except from the aerial view, is in the record, but I think the court could take judicial notice by looking it up on Google Maps. This was a simple, ordinary, one-story, small, suburban house. There were no special, what the district court found did not amount to emergency circumstances involving the house. I'd also point out the record is very murky why, although it was a Saturday, August 19th, they weren't able to get a warrant. They apparently had made preparations. There's some reference to they couldn't get the district attorney on the phone. Indiana does allow telephone warrants. They could have, as opposing counsel points out, they didn't know the address. They could have simply prepared the warrant with everything but the address and filled in the address by phone or email. If I could say one more point, Your Honor, about harmless error, even if there was probable cause and therefore Mr. Escobedo's statements post-arrest to Officer Ray still come in, there is the lack of exigency would still be grounds for excluding the other testimony, which was very damaging about the conditions inside the house, the fact that Mr. Escobedo had allegedly opened the trunk. As Mr. Geller himself said in the suppression hearing, he argued to the judge that that testimony was very damaging because it corroborated the government's overall theory of the case. So that is not harmless error. The government has not been able to show that that testimony wouldn't make the difference.
But the marijuana had been seized earlier, right? And we had the cell phone.
Yes, it was back in Phoenix, Your Honor.
Yeah, and we have the cell phone conversations. Wouldn't that probably be enough?
Well, the marijuana being seized shows that Rachel Summers had marijuana and that she accused Mr. Escobedo of implication. The conversations show that she was driving a car back from him. It didn't show that she wasn't driving a car back from him in which she or she and some cohort had decided to place marijuana. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Lahn, I'd like to extend an additional thanks to you and the law school and the students for accepting this appointment and so ably representing the petitioner.
Pleasure, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement.